in the world because before this, there was no death. That's one of the interesting features that comes about as a result of the fall. In fact, the very first thing that they're warned about is death. And so there was no death. Things were very much different. The earth was surrounded by a vapor canopy, as seen in the initial restoration of the planet in Genesis 1, where God stretches thin this word here in Genesis 1, in verse 6. God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." The word expanse is rakia in the Hebrew, and means that which has been pounded thin. That which has been, it was used for instance, of overlaying gold over a particular object. And so obviously they didn't make the whole object out of gold. They would just put a veneer of gold over it. Well, that's what this word means. It means a stretching thin. And God made the expanse which separated the waters which were below the expanse. Now, the waters which were below the expanse are seen in verse 2. In a situation in which they are gradually being warmed by the Spirit of God, the earth had been packed in ice following the fall of Satan. Satan and his demons were the occupants of this planet. The irony is there's so much of science fiction that is actually science fact, but they'd have it backwards. For instance, in Star Wars, it didn't happen in a galaxy far, far away a long time ago. It happened here. That's where the rebellion was set up. And so the inhabitants were evicted from this world and kicked off. The world was packed in ice, which made it uninhabitable, of course. And then we see God, the Holy Spirit, as it says here, all it says is moving. But it doesn't really convey what the word means in verse 2. It has the idea of a bird, a fowl, hovering over its eggs, over its young, to keep them warm. It has the idea of brooding. If you, those of you who came from a farm will know what that means. The rest of you will sit there and think, what does brooding mean? Is that James Dean? Very brooding. No, it's not that. It's different than that. It sounds the same, but they mean different things. And so, he warms this water up. And now we see the water. At the end of day one, all he does is create light and darkness. That at this point, that whatever light had been in the universe essentially went out at the fall of Satan. This was God's judgment on Satan, was the withdrawal of light. This manifests that Satan is darkness. His viewpoint is darkness. It's evil. It will kill you. It is toxic. It is poison. And he feeds it to the human race slowly but surely with the IV drip through the sin nature. And that's how it works. And so evil is constantly around you. You can't help it. But this is the forces of darkness. And God separates. He makes a distinction between the light and the darkness. And he calls the light day, and he calls the darkness night. There was evening and there was morning one day. Which is ironic that the Jews, and now if you're familiar with the Jewish train of thought, Hebrews, they begin their day at sundown because of this verse. Which is as dumb as anything I've ever heard. The reality is that when it says there was evening and there was morning, and by the way, for those who want to make this evolutionary in its scope, that the days are actually eras or eons, thousands and thousands of years, that will not work in these passages. Exegetically, it does not fit. Evening and morning, while day and night are used metaphorically, light and darkness are used metaphorically. Terms evening and morning are never used metaphorically. They are technical. They mean what they mean. The period between daylight and dark as it's going dusk. Evening and morning. And what it dawned on me is that when it says there was one day, they thought, oh, well, God measures his days from evening to morning. No. Think about it. It became evening, it says, meaning that it was not evening prior to that, that he did this during what we would call the course of the day. And so his day, his cycle ran from morning till morning, just like ours pretty much does. And these works are not done at night. The day didn't start in the evening. The day ended in the evening. And it still does. And so he puts an expanse. He stretches thin. What that thin stretching is our atmosphere, comprised of various gases, some of which we need, some of which are inert, some of which we don't need. But they are in the right proportion. This is an astonishingly amazing evolutionary deal. That this atmosphere just happened to evolve in exactly the right proportions. Because I guess the evolutionary, well, there was no mind, knew that man was coming and would need oxygen. Why do you need oxygen? If you don't have human inhabitants, you don't need oxygen. Angels don't need oxygen. God doesn't need oxygen. And so all of this, we see one of the things you see is that one, God is very orderly, very sequential, and very, we might almost call it plodding in this part of Genesis, because he doesn't do a whole lot, but what he does and does quickly. Now, as it gets towards later days, 4, 5, and 6, there's a lot of activity. But again, it's just spoken into existence, so that's easy enough for him. Well, when it says there was evening and there was morning, well, that's one day. That means from morning to morning, the following morning constituted one day. He just didn't mention the first morning. But for it to become evening indicated that it had been day. And so there you have a day. Then he stretches this out, and waters are above. Here's the earth, and it's still covered completely with water, no land mass visible. But he stretches it out, and he separates the waters above. And for years, I mean, in some of the old cosmologies, they looked at this and they said, you know, there was literally a heavenly ocean that surrounded the earth. Well, I don't know a lot about physics, but I know that the atmosphere can't support water, not in liquid form. The water in liquid form falls. You can't suspend it above the atmosphere. So this leads to basic common sense and science and understanding, and that this vapor canopy was steam, essentially. It had to be steam. Steam is the only thing that's heavier than air. It rises. And of course, as you get towards the outer limits of the air, and as the air gets thinner, it only can rise so far. Because literally the force of space would stop it. It would just deteriorate. Disperse. And so there's this vapor canopy that surrounds the earth. This is a wonderful thing. This allows for, number one, the sun's harmful radiation is filtered out. This explains partly, at least partly, not totally, but partly, why man lives such a long time. And again, any idea that days here or weeks or months or years mean anything than what they normally mean is just people trying to do a number on the Bible. Because they are literal. And that is real evident if you stay here in Genesis 1, but look in Genesis 6. You will see that God knows precisely the difference. And I'm sorry, Genesis 7. Moses knows the difference. 7:11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that same day, all the fountains of the deep were burst open. Okay, so he knows the difference between a day and a month and a year. It's not hard. And Moses, of course, as we know, was schooled in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Do you think he's just an idiot? I mean, this guy was schooled in the premier kingdom on the planet at that time. Had the greatest of educations. You suggest to me he didn't know what a day was? I don't have that much faith. I can't believe that. Well, it filters out the sun's harmful rays, and essentially, guess what? Because of this, the earth is what we would call a giant terrarium. And so, because it's a giant terrarium, it doesn't rain. And that will be seen if you look ahead a second to Genesis 2, verses 5 and 6. Now, no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no plant had sprouted, for the Lord had not sent rain on the earth. And there was no man to cultivate the ground, but a mist used to rise from the ground, from the earth, and water the whole surface of the ground. Well, if you've ever seen a terrarium, it basically is an ecosystem within itself. And, of course, it has to be a closed system. That's another factor. Your terrarium has to be closed. It can't be exposed to outside forces. I worked at a glass factory for years, and I made this really neat one I wish I still had it, kind of, but it was always a pain to move because it was all glass with a mirror reflection on the back, and then the top of it was glass. And so you could see into it at all times. And it had some nice little plants. And what would happen is, as the temperature in the house, as the ambient temperature changed within the house, as it got warmer, you would see the condensation within the stuff would evaporate. And then as it cooled down, you would see it would condense again. And you would see there was this constant cycle of water within. All you have to do to a terrarium is just have some water to start with. And you close that in. If it's got soil, nutrients, you got to have that. But water and that and the plant. And once you close it, you're done. It is maintenance free. I like those kind of things. That's why I don't have pets. They are not maintenance free. Plants, closer to maintenance free. Terrarium, totally maintenance free. So if you want to, you know, get you some plants, and then you can go by. If you're lonely, you can talk to them. Hi, plant. How you doing? Say hi to your mom for me. So the water would, as the evening came on, a layer of dew would settle down on the ground, and then with the heating of the day, that would evaporate back out, condense back out at night, evaporate out, condense out, and you have this wonderful cycle where you don't need anything. The earth itself is full of nutrients. Plants, God has already put there, or He will by the time He finishes all this. And so this greenhouse effect, in the real sense though, this terrarium effect, has the idea of a lot of things, but the idea here is that this is only temporary. This is going to be precipitated out at the flood, and things are going to change dramatically after that, which is what the biblical account reflects. And so God puts this up here, puts man on the planet, and then gives him one simple command. I actually had three commands, to be truth be told. He was told to manage the garden, to farm it, i.e. to trim it, to keep it looking nice, was essentially what he was told to do. That is found in Genesis 2, 15. And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden. Two things: to cultivate it, i.e. to keep it trimmed, to keep it looking nice, because it's going to grow pretty exuberantly. And secondarily, to guard it. That word keep means to watch over, to guard. Which should have told Adam that there was a danger lurking. Why? What am I guarding it from? That should have been his question. That would have been a very good question, in fact. Why am I? What do I have to guard the garden for? There's nobody here but me and Eve, and she's not a threat. So what's the deal? Well, there's the warning right there, the subtle warning in Genesis that there's evil afoot already. And so he tells him, okay, you can eat every tree. But from the tree of knowledge of good and evil you will not eat. For in the day you eat, dying you will die. You will absolutely surely die. And he died spiritually. That's the only way he died. He didn't die physically. He didn't die emotionally. He didn't die in any other way other than spiritually. And so when he dies spiritually, we've seen all this. They play the blame game. You got to love that. Then he talks to Adam in verse 17 of chapter 2, or 3, I'm sorry, chapter 3. Because you have listened to the voice of your wife. That's an indictment in this case. So women, every time you think you're right, you might need to stifle yourself sometimes, Edith. And that's not fun doctrine to hear. I understand that, because husbands can be, I know how husbands can be, believe me, I are one. And the fact is, if Adam had not listened to Eve in that day, things would have been different. But we can second guess all we want. Monday morning quarterbacks are a dime a dozen. And they all know how to play the game, except they don't play it. So we can criticize Adam, we can criticize all this, but the fact is, he shouldn't have listened to Eve at that time, because he had a higher authority telling him something else. His higher authority, God, had told him not to eat. And Eve is not even his authority. And essentially, Adam submitted to her authority. A complete role reversal from what God had established. And so, for the man to submit to the wife's authority, hogwash. Any idea that that's the way it's supposed to be is just a matriarchal remnant from a bad family upbringing. Because the reality is, women aren't to run this planet. They never were to. Now, that doesn't make them slaves, second-class citizens, or any of the other things. You're a misogynist. No, I'm not. I just understand that things have to be in their place if they're going to function properly. If your tires are not attached to your axle securely, believe me, at 70 miles an hour, you're looking at a catastrophic accident. Things have to be in their place. And when they're not, things go wrong. And that's just a simple fact. And so, he said, you've listened, and you've eaten from the tree. Now, cursed is the ground because of you. And this is the only curse, by the way. There were two curses pronounced that day. One on Satan, the serpent. Dual figure. He was there in the presence of the serpent. And also the ground. Adam and Eve were not cursed. You'll notice that this language, cursing, is not used of Adam and Eve. It is used simply of the environment and the instigator, Satan. In toil. This word is that word that means amal. It deals with that laborious aspect of work that isn't fun. Now, if you have a job you like, work is not laborious. It may not be fun like, ha, 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 I'm out partying. But it also does not have the character of beating you up and dragging you down that hard, rigorous labor does. And so what he's saying here, his things, all you had in the garden is going to be lost to you now. In that sense. In toil you will eat of it, with hard work all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles, weeds and thistles, it'll grow for you. And you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face, you will eat bread. Interesting concept here. Think about what was bread? Do you ever think Adam has seen bread by this time? Did he think he knew what it was? He didn't. Bread is something that comes from the ground, but is a processed food. It's not directly, you don't eat it like you would nuts and berries. In their raw, natural form. So he's indicating here, even in Genesis, you can see that God anticipates technology. Because in order to make bread, you've got to have certain technology. You can do it all by hand, but you've got to have the capability of fire. You've got to have the capability of a place to put it. You have to have an understanding of how it works. You have to have yeast, if you're going to make the kind of bread we usually have. So there's a lot that goes into it. Not a lot of ingredients, but still difficulty. And he said, you're going to do this till you return from the ground. So the earth is cursed. So now man lives in an environment that's no longer amenable to him. It is an environment that is hostile to him, in fact. And that's one of the reasons we suffer. We live in this world that we come into, and it's not naturally susceptible to man's rule. Man has to work at it. And in fact, it's kind of alluded to. If you look back in Genesis 1, verse 28, be fruitful and multiply, as he says. That's a command for sexual prosperity. And fill the earth and subdue it. That word subdue indicates that it's not going to be easy. It's not going to yield itself to him necessarily as it did in the garden. Because obviously when God said subdue it, it's true both times. He has to subdue the garden, i.e. he has to keep it trimmed and nice and all of that. But then the word takes on a more ominous tone after the fall. That the subjugation of the earth isn't going to be easy. It's not simple for the earth to give up what it has. And I don't know if you ever watch a show called Gold Rush. And there's this guy working on this, it was a dredge that hasn't been run in like 40 or 50 years up in Alaska. This thing he bought for $1 million, hadn't been run in 50 years, so how good could it be, right? He has to take it, completely disassemble it, move it 50 miles. And I mean, we're talking parts that are 8,000, 12,000, 20,000 pounds, each little increment of the dredge that he's got to haul. And he does all this. And this just, to me, just reinforces the whole Genesis account. I'm like, yeah, see how hard it is? You can't get gold. If you could just get gold by walking it out and picking it up off the ground, well, we'd all be doing it, wouldn't we? But no, do you have $1 million to sink into a dredge? Do you want to live in Alaska year round? Or even 6 months out of the year or whatever? And so you have this problem where the earth is no longer going to be just, it's not going to be status quo, it's going to be hard. And part of that is made even more difficult now. You introduce the sin nature to that. And man's patience is not what it was. His other spiritual factors are not what they were. Well, we have the cursed world. Now that is seen in Romans. Paul alludes to that issue that we face as a part of our sufferings. In Romans 8. And again, which we will be coming up, we will be looking at all of this in greater detail. He talks about the sufferings are not worthy to be compared with the glory. For the anxious longing of the creation awaits eagerly. Here he personifies creation as being under bondage, and that the children of God are going to set it free as we come into our resurrection bodies set up a new regime. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will also be set free from its slavery to corruption, into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And the fact is, the world is a tough place. It's designed to be a tough place. You may want to protect your children, and that's legitimate. I understand that as a parent, you have a desire to do so. But you know what? Your children are going to have to learn some real hard lessons in life. And you can't protect them from all of them. There are going to be incorrigible people out there. There are going to be predators. There are going to be con men, swindlers, scammers, Madoffs, OJs, all these types of people. And you can't protect them from all of them. And you can't protect them from this world system. The only thing that can, really, is God's word. So they better have that. That is their protection. That is their resource. And so the world itself is in a bad way right now. And we see that change. We'll see it reflected, say, in the millennial passages of where men live. If they don't live 100 years, they're going to be thought to be cursed. The child will play at the nursing cobra's den. Wouldn't recommend it now. The lion and the ox will lie down together, and the lion's going to eat straw like the ox. If a lion and an ox lay down right now, the lion's eating the ox. That's what's going to happen. But all of that's going to change. So we see that the world we live in, is temporarily cursed. But that is going to be rectified as well. Also, Ecclesiastes 9:3. This deals with the propensity that man has because of the sin nature to do that, to sin. There is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Not a pretty picture. And you see this. You see the insanity of mankind. Here's the Almighty Eternal God, the Creator, offering them a relationship with Himself, and man says, nah, not interested. What are you going to have then? You're going to have a relationship with Satan. That's all you're going to have by default. You don't get another choice. There are only two options in this reality we call life. And so their hearts are full of evil and insanity. This doesn't mean they're occasionally crazy. It means mankind's full-on bonkers. I mean, the inmates are running the asylum. You get that, right? And so what passes as morality and goodness and all of that is in some cases merely a facade to cover the reality that the inmates are running the asylum. And so, but that doesn't change. And they're full of it. It's not occasional. And it's throughout their lives. It's not just, oh, they'll outgrow it. You like to think kids that outgrow stuff. Some things they do. But other things they never do. They never outgrow some real insane thoughts sometimes. They believe weird stuff. And all of us can. But again, the protection is up here in the mind. What you know, what you think, where your focus is. So B, the second reason that believers suffer is found in the fact that they have aligned themselves with God in the angelic conflict. Nevertheless, believers still live in the devil's world. There's no doubt for anyone that knows anything about the Bible that this world has been usurped by the usurper. It has been Adam, who was the federal agent, the moral agent under God, under his authority, to administrate the earth, stepped aside. He forfeited that position. when he fell. He could no longer administrate God's world in the righteousness way that God desires. Well, guess what? Satan said, okay, I'll step in and take over. I've always wanted the planet anyway. It was my headquarters after all. So this is just turnabout's fair play. Way to go. All right. And so Satan probably feels pretty good at the fall. I got to believe he does. He kills Adam and Eve spiritually. He takes back control of the earth. A nicely remodeled earth, by the way. It wasn't the dump that the judgment of God had made it before. It's restored. So Satan probably feels pretty good about all this at this point in his history. And he continues to run the world. This idea that it's God's world or that God and Satan are fighting it out in the world. No, this is the devil's world. He owns it. He knows it. Jesus didn't argue with him when he said it. We'll see that. 2:2, we talk about the course of this world, which is also according to the prince of the power of the air. That spirit which is now working in the sons of disobedience. So you've got that also, Ephesians 6:12. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the world forces of this darkness. Interestingly enough, that word world forces is katokrasmos or katokrasmer in the Greek. And it has the idea of cosmos, of the world, but of a strong world ruler. And basically, these are powerful, very powerful demons under Satan that run his operation. Satan is organized at some level. Now, if you ever have read it, I don't know if you have, but C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters, which is kind of humorous. Because it's about this, the Screwtape Letters is essentially this minor demon writing back and forth to his boss, reporting in on what's going on. And then the major demon giving him advice as to how mankind can be exploited and these kinds of things. It's fiction, by the way, but it reads like today's newspaper. And so, it was a pretty interesting little book, I thought. But you have these, to some extent, an organization, an evil organization, that spans the globe and encircles it. You can't get away from it. It's everywhere. And the only place it probably isn't, they probably don't like hanging out in Bible class. They probably, demons probably don't like that. That wouldn't seem to be up their alley, I wouldn't think. So, the world forces of this darkness against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. And you can also see Revelation 12:17. I think that's where he talks about Satan and his character. Well, this is actually the final. We're getting on towards the end of Daniel 70th week here. The dragon was enraged with the woman. The woman is Israel. And went off to make war with the rest of her children, who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And in this case, the woman isn't just national Israel, it's really spiritual Israel he's after. We've gotten a big dose in Romans, and you should know the difference between natural Israel and spiritual Israel. You should know the difference between a natural man and a spiritual man. And the fact is, that it gets into a spiritual reality rather than a fleshly one. All Israel is not Israel, as it says in another place. So sufferings are necessary in order to complete the corporate suffering that is the heritage of the body of Christ. Colossians 1:24, that simply because of the angelic conflict, that as you saw, well, we haven't seen yet, but it's in a point coming up here, about the sufferings of Christ, that his life was one of suffering. Guess what? Believers are going to follow suit. He said, if you're going to be my disciple, what are you going to have to do? Pick up your cross, deny yourself, and follow me. Well, guess what? That is going to entail suffering. There's no doubt about it. And Colossians 1:24 talks about that. I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake. And in my flesh, I do my share on behalf of his body, which is the church, in filling up what is lacking in Christ's afflictions. And so we have corporately, there's X amount of suffering determined that the body's going to have to go through. Well, you and I contribute to that when we suffer righteously for God's plan. D, when a believer suffers in fellowship on behalf of God's plan, he glorifies God by his obedience. 1 Peter 4:16. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, in other words, you're suffering because of doctrine, your stance for the truth. It's not just because, oh, I'm a believer. That can be part of it. But more so that you've taken a stand in the angelic conflict that brings heat on you. And as you probably know, in any warfare, the way to avoid heat is stay off the front lines. You know, there's not nearly as much heat at the rear. And so, but then again, you're not doing any real fighting at the rear then either, are you? No, you're not. So here he says, if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. And he points out, it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome of those who do not obey the gospel of God? And believe me, we're going to endure a pretty rigid testing. A pretty rigid judgment. It's God's not going to cut corners when it comes to believers. Oh, you're a believer, so I'm giving you special privileges. No, you're going to have applied the doctrine. Either that or no. So sufferings, point E here, are designed to cause believers to rely on the power of God and not to trust their own abilities. Let's face it, from our earliest days, if we had normal parents, we were taught to be self-sufficient. This is a part of normal human existence. I see it all the time in these survival shows where they're trying to teach their kids basic skills. I remember there was more of an emphasis on this back when I was a child. They may still have some on it, not as much. But you had to learn how to start a fire. You had to learn how to tie certain knots. You had to learn how to field dress an animal. You had to learn how to deal with stuff. How to shoot. How to handle firearms properly. All the kinds of things that went into, really, life. If you were going to live any sort of outdoors subsistence type existence. Or even if you weren't. If you were still going to do those things, you wanted to go camping from time to time. You got to know how to set up a tent. Of course, nowadays, they got them, you know, you fold it up, it's about the size of your hand, you just throw it and it's there. Well, technology's not helping us there. But, so we're taught from a pretty early age to be self-sufficient. There's nothing wrong with self-sufficiency until it comes to God. Human self-sufficiency gets in the way of God's grace. And again, while it's you have to, from a physical perspective, you got to be able to balance it. See, there are certain things they need to know now. Now, given the technology and all, you need to know how to type more than you need to know how to sharpen a stick. You know, if you can't type at a keyboard, you're not going to be all that productive, probably. Typing is very important. I remember when I took typing, my dad laughed at me. And because I only took it because I thought it would be an easy A anyway. It wasn't like I really thought, oh boy, typing. You know, and there were more chicks in the typing class. I was a normal boy. And but now you need different skills. Well, you still better be learning some skill sets. But again, the problem with man's skill sets and his self-independence is that it sort of rules out any need for God. I can take care of it all by myself. You better learn how to operate a bank book or run a financial program and a spreadsheet and other things that you're going to need to know. Now the emphasis is on advanced mathematics, more so in geometry and other factors than it ever was, say, at the beginning. Of course, I lived sort of pre-computer. Oh, how did you even live? Yeah, we lived. We roughed it. The phone rang, we answered it. We were frontiersmen, man. We took every chance with our lives. We didn't have caller ID. 2 Corinthians 1:8-10. We do not want you to be unaware, brothers, of our affliction, which came to us in Asia. And we were burdened excessively beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, we had the sentence of death within ourselves, so that we would not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a peril of death and will deliver us. And he on whom we have set our hope. So the idea here is, again, there's nothing wrong with self-sufficiency. But recognize in your self-sufficiency, you don't have everything. And God can use things to work against you or for you. You may be very self-sufficient. I watch these guys. I mean, you hear about it all the time on these shows. I hear about it. People go off. They were going on a hike. They were just disappeared from the face of the planet. Nobody knows where they are. Oh, they were self-sufficient. They could hike, camp, make fire, do all the things you needed to do. Oh, but the grizzly got them at night. You can't prepare for that. Uh-oh, the wolverine came into camp. Those are nasty little creatures. And some people, your stories, 200 or 300 every year. Actually, had I known this, I might not have gone. One out of 200 people that visits Alaska doesn't make it back. That's a lot. One out of 200, that's a pretty high percentage, really. When you consider that they're concerned, about various diseases that only afflict one out of every 2 million or something. Or one out of every 15,000. I would have still gone. But we were in a situation where a little bear cub wandered out into the path 30 yards in front of us or so. And had he headed that way and mommy comes barreling after him, you could be dead. And you wouldn't have a snowball's chance. So the idea is that, yeah, self-sufficiency is good, but your life depends on God. And that is something people should not forget. Also, 2 Corinthians 12, 7 through 10. And so, again, and particularly in terms of spiritual matters, this is where Paul gets this thorn in the flesh, this messenger of Satan, to torment me. Why in verse 7? To keep me from exalting myself, to keep me from getting too big in the britches, to think I'm too much. I asked the Lord 3 times to remove it. And he said, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am content with all these things, weaknesses, insults, distresses, persecutions, and difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. And sometimes God's power shows through works in the life of the believer when he's at his absolute weakest point. That God intervenes. I found out, just by the way, to give you an update for any of you who know John Ritchie, he had a heart attack. They had to shock him 4 times, I think. 2 before they got him in the ambulance, 1 in the ambulance, once when he got to the hospital. They basically put him into a medically induced coma because they couldn't do anything at that point. He was too weak. And they bring him out of it and find out in the cath lab, well, he only had 1 blockage. It was 80%, but it was only 1 artery. Well, they put ran the balloon through it, put the stent in, and boom, he's now back in a normal room already within a space of a week. But I guarantee you, there was a lot of prayers being fired up on that one. The reality is, obviously, God can take us out at any time under any circumstances, and we have to recognize that and be cool with it. It's God's, it's God's life. He gave it to me, but he has the right to take it back at some point. That we're not here, certainly one of the things we know, we're not immortal here on earth, and we're not designed to be. Would you want to live how can you imagine if you lived immortality in an accursed body, a body of flesh and sin? You had to live in this just decade after decade after century after century. And the body's gradually, it's mortal, so it's breaking down, getting older and older and older and older. And by the end, there's not a whole lot you can do once you get to a certain age. So God has to take care of you. Also, 1 Peter 4:19. Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And you do what's right, you leave it in God's hands and let Him work in it. Believers suffer in order to be trained in the divine viewpoint, point F here, and to produce further spiritual growth. Psalm 119 is interesting. It's that acrostic psalm. comprise really each verse begins with the same letter of the Hebrew alphabet: Aleph, Beth, Gimel, Dalet, Hey. So it's and every one of them is the same length. But it mostly focuses on the nature of God's Word and its importance in life. Before I was afflicted, in verse 67, I went astray. See, here's one of the problems in the world is prosperity. You think, well, that's not a problem. I wouldn't mind that. Test me and see. But prosperity is a problem. As a matter of fact, I was watching, I was only caught part of a little movie yesterday, and this girl was giving a report on society. She said all cultures go through the same cycles. They go through a period of initial adversity, strengthening, where they become strong, and suffering all through all of this to get to a certain point. Then they reach their peak. Then prosperity and other things set in, and then they began a slow decline into destruction. And that's been true of every culture on the planet ever. And that's going to be true of ours, sadly. And you already see it. Well, sometimes when things are too easy, people don't learn anything. When things are too easy and it's all handed to them, they're not developing character. They're not learning how to do without. Where Paul says, I know how to live in times of adversity and times of prosperity. People need both. Everybody thinks, oh no, I just need the prosperity, pass on the adversity. But it's the adversity that develops character. And the fact is, without it, as he says, I went astray, but now I keep your word, indicating you afflicted me. That God himself afflicted him, and it was for his own benefit. Also, verse 71, it is good for me that I was afflicted, that I may learn your statutes. And one of the things when you suffer, have you ever noticed that during the course of life when things are going fairly good, that you don't pray as much? And then the second things start to go wrong, you're right there ready to go. And it may not be quite that dramatic. I understand, you know, I tend to pray. But I've noticed that it is a matter that it's easier not to pray when things are going good. And when things are going bad, people really, you know, somebody has a heart attack, boom, let's pray. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, that's fine. But I'm just saying that adversity sometimes pushes the believer in a better direction, frankly. But what's our natural human tendency under the flesh? To avoid adversity, if we can, to avoid suffering. That's our natural tendency. So we have to entrust our souls to a Creator in doing what is right. Hebrews also 12:11. Again, here in a matter now of divine discipline, which is a part of suffering. All discipline for the moment does not seem to be joyful, but sorrowful. You're not going to like it. Yet to those who have been trained by it. By the way, if you're not trained by discipline, you're not trained. Discipline is a part of everything in life. There isn't anything that doesn't involve discipline. And I don't mean necessarily corporal punishment. I'm talking about various disciplines that you have to engage in life. Up to and including corporal punishment, I include that as a part of discipline. Beat your child with a rod lest they die. That means obviously we don't really get rods and beat them. But the idea is corporal punishment. And that's part of it. That's not all of the things that we might have to endure in there. But it's sorrowful, all suffering, all discipline. Yet to those who have been trained by it, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. But you got to be trained by it. You've got to submit to it. You've got to say, okay, God knows what's best. I may not know here. Also, 1 Peter 5:10. And after you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. And you will become like the believer pictured in Psalm 1, who's like a tree planted by the banks of the water, and his roots grow deep, and he produces fruit, and he's stable. And that's exactly what you want to be. Suffering may not only produce greater levels of spiritual growth, God may use it to vindicate his viewpoint in the angelic conflict. The entire book of Job, we're not going to read it, but God obviously knew what was going on. He allowed Satan a certain leeway, a freedom, in afflicting Job, in testing him, and providing suffering for him. And ultimately, at the end of it all, when Job gets to the point, we know Job cracks spiritually, and then he begins to question God. Then he begins to flat out accuse God of not being righteous. Well, that's not a good way to go. And then at the end of it, God comes out, and the voice comes out of the whirlwind and says, "Gird up your loins, now let's talk." And Job doesn't want to talk anymore. He says, "I will lay my hand upon my mouth, for I have spoken once, and that was more than enough." And when God takes you on, and one of the things you see there in the book of Job, people think, "Oh, well, I'll be able to deal with God." When God showed up, everything changed. It all changed, and quickly, including Job's attitude. Well, God uses suffering to produce the virtue of patience. We've just covered that. Romans 5, 3 and 4. Also, Hebrews 10, 32 through 39. Suffering and patience it produces are a necessary part of the maturity adjustment. James 1, 2. Consider it all joy when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, that is patience, hupomone, and let patience have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect, i.e. mature. You're never going to be, that's one of the things you've got to, the English words sometimes obscure what's going on here. Because when we think of perfect, you know, we think of without any flaw at all. When you talk about a perfect game, he didn't walk a batter. Nobody got a hit. But even within that perfect game, he missed his mark quite a few times. Well, pitchers throw a lot of balls. The idea here is mature. Not just perfect in every way, but mature where you meet God's standard and that is acceptable. Suffering is necessary in order to test the believer's doctrine, which is vindicated when he applies it to his testings. And those applications are the basis for SG3. We're in James 1. Let's read 12 here. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. And as we've seen in 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7 there, the testing, if necessary, and it is necessary, you are encountering various sufferings. That the testing of your faith will result, if you apply, in praise, glory, and honor, and those other factors. Rewards will be distributed based on one's willingness to acclimate to his sufferings. Romans 8, 17. Your level of reward is going to be commensurate with your level of application. What sufferings you were willing to endure, what sufferings you weren't. People draw a line and say, "I'm not willing to do that." And you know what God's going to do at the bema seat? He's going to say, "Well, there's your little line, and here's all that you could have had, dummy, on the other side of it, and you just lined up on the wrong side of the deal." As a believer, you better be careful about drawing a line in the sand with God. He takes it seriously. Romans 8, 17, "And if we are children, and we are heirs also, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ. If indeed we suffer with him, so that we may also be glorified with him." And the normative Christian experience is one in which the believer enters into willingly the sufferings of Christ through this life, applies the doctrine under the heat of the angelic conflict in the devil's world, and makes good decisions with respect to his own spiritual life. And then that level of reward will be commensurate with that level of suffering. So the more one suffers, if he does it in fellowship, we're talking, all things have to be equal. He's got to be in fellowship, right mental attitude, all that. But the more one suffers, generally speaking, the greater the glory is going to be for that person. And the person that seeks to avoid suffering for the cause of Christ, they're going to be embarrassed in that day. And Jesus talked about that there at the end, in Mark. We saw that when he was talking about the matter of being a disciple. Mark 8, 38. Well, actually, 34 begins the section here. "If anyone wishes to come after me," i.e., again, to follow me, to be my disciple. There's a difference between a believer and a disciple. We know that. He must deny himself. It's not optional. And take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. See, you got your own agenda, your own plans, your own schedule and all of that. And God says, I'm not interested in your agenda, your plan, and your schedule. I've got my own. And mine's greater than yours. It's bigger. It's more important. And it has greater long-term ramifications and greater potential for reward if one acclimates to it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, it's got to be for my sake and the gospel. It's got to be according to the doctrine that you're making the sacrifices because of. See, these people today, now here's where they get this weird idea. They say, well, I'm going to give up my life here in America. I'm going to travel over to Nigeria and I'm going to be a missionary there. And God will reward me for all of this because I'm making such great sacrifices. If he didn't want you to go, you're not getting an ounce of reward for that. And by the way, when people who are not parts of local churches or who are a part of a local church and then abandon all that and go off and do their own thing, that's not God doing that. They will tell you that it is. They will say, oh, God's in this. God's not in this. God's in the local church. That's where God's in. And people that want to violate that, blow it off, manipulate it, do whatever they want to do so they can get what they want, well, are going to find out that in the end, they're going to lose. So you may live a great life here on planet Earth. You may be an excellent hunter. You go out every day. You get your limit. You may be a great fisherman. You go out every day. You get your limit. You live your life like you want to. Obviously, all of us have to work a job, so nobody probably lives their life exactly like they want to. But we all have to work. And so you may have all of this temporal blessing. You may run with the stars, whoever they are this week. God help you if you end up in Bieber's posse. Well, these people come and they go. Flame is famous fleeting. And so people get what they want in this world. Let's say you achieve it all. Let's say you pursue your career and your goals and your agenda and your dream and you get it all. If it's not commensurate with what God's actual plan for you was, you've lost it all. And you've wasted your whole life losing it. That's what's sad. And so he says, whoever is ashamed of me, verse 38, and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes. Again, how is that going to play out? I don't want to know. I don't want to know, but I have a sense that there's going to be a lot of believers who find out when the Lord looks at them and just sneers. That won't be good. They're going to realize then, well, it's too late, though, sadly. All right, well, oops, we went a little over there. Time's up. Let's stop there. Let's go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break. We'll pick up here about 7 after today.